Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 1985 movie Back to the Future, teenager Marty McFly jumped in a crazy scientist's DeLorean and found himself in 1955. The pair was played by Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd. Fox had to make sure his parents would meet and get married, or else he wouldn't exist. There would be no future to get back to. The film was a major success, with the soundtrack filled with music, including hits from Huey Lewis. Well, that success is being duplicated every night on Broadway and here in Charlotte at Blumenthal Performing Arts Belk Theater, where once again the characters and the audience time travel back to 1955, this time in a musical.
Great Scott! Marty! I've just become the world's first time traveler!
A time machine? A time machine? Whoa, wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Well, if you're gonna build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style? I'm the architect of TikTok tech. I frequent flyer on a cosmic trek. Sorted through the quarks and quirks.
After years of considering how the movie could be transferred to the stage and turned into a musical, Back to the Future opened its Olivier-winning run in London's West End in 2021, followed by packed houses on Broadway, and now the tour is here, all for one reason.
It works, it works, it works, it works. In terms of the vernacular, it's spectacular, because it works.
Back to the Future works in large part both as a movie and a musical, thanks to our guest this hour. Bob Gale is not only the co-creator of both projects, he wrote the film screenplay and the book for the musical. He's also a producer, and we invited him, and lo and behold, he accepted our invitation to join us for this hour to reflect on his work, its enduring appeal, and the process that transformed a classic film series, actually, into the musical on stage at the Belk Theater this week. Bob Gale, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Hi, Mike. Good morning for me, earlier than you, but yes, happy to be here. Love Charlotte. My brother and his family lives there. I've been there many times, and I'm only sorry I couldn't make the logistics work out to be in a studio with you personally this morning.
Yeah, I was told by Tom Gabbard, who runs the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center, that your brother lives here. Is he in the movie business? What's he do?
He was in the movie business, but my nephew, his son Jonathan, is autistic, and my brother got out of the movie business to devote his time to autism. He became a special education teacher and worked in Charlotte for many years to try to use the knowledge that he garnered about how to communicate with these kids to make a better life for them.
And there's another tie to Back to the Future, the musical. My eye doctor's son, Will Branner, is in the Broadway cast.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he just turned over his 1,000th performance, evidently. So there's a big Charlotte connection to Back to the Future, the musical. It's become the movie and the series of movies are American classics now, which I think is an achievement that is rare. And it's the kind of movie that if you chance upon it while switching channels, if it's on TV, you stop, you sit, you watch, even if you've seen it 1,000 times before and you know all of the dialogue. It's an achievement that we'll talk about, but where did the initial idea for this come from?
This was just a real happy accident. I'm originally from a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, University City. And I was visiting my parents in the summer of 1980, and I was digging around in the basement. I found my father's high school yearbook. Now, I attended the same high school that my dad did, and I'd never seen his yearbook. I said, oh, this kind of be cool to see what my high school looked like in 1940. So I'm thumbing through the yearbook, and lo and behold, my dad was the president of his graduating class. And I'm looking at this photograph of my dad looking very prim and proper. And I'm thinking about the president of my graduating class, who was one of these rah-rah Sochi guys who I would never have anything to do with. And I thought, gee whiz, was my dad that guy? If I had gone to high school with my dad, would I have even been friends with him? And that's when the proverbial bolt of lightning hit me. And I said, there is a movie.
Wow. And you were right. You wrote that original script with Robert Zemeckis, who also directed that film. And that film became, I think, the top grossing film of 1985.
It made in its original run, well, worldwide, it made like $365 million. In the U.S., it made $210. And remember, we're talking about 1985, 1986 dollars. Yeah. The movie opened almost exactly 39 years ago on July 3rd, 1985, and it played in theaters all the way into March 1986. And obviously, this is before streaming and home video and everything, so people wanted to see it again and again and again. There was only one way they could do that, and that was by going to the movies.
You and Robert Zemeckis also were nominated for Oscars and Golden Globes for that first film, but your relationship with Robert Zemeckis predates that movie. How long had you known each other?
We met at USC Film School in the fall of 1971. He was from the Midwest as well, south side of Chicago, and we were both undergraduates in what at that time was largely graduate department, and we both wanted to make Hollywood-type movies. There were a lot of graduate students there who were espousing the virtues of the French New Wave and Jean-Luc Godard and Truffaut, and we were talking about Walt Disney and Dirty Harry and James Bond.
How much of the success of the original film and the two that followed, and now the Broadway musical Back to the Future, how much of it is due, well, at least with the movies, is due not just to the story, but to the fact that Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd were in those films?
Well, a tremendous amount of success is owed to the fact that Michael J. Fox is in the movie. Some people don't remember or don't know this. We actually could not get Michael into the picture when we wanted to start shooting it. He was busy with his TV series Family Ties. Mm-hmm. So at the urging of the CEO of Universal MCA, who for whatever reason decided he was going to take a personal interest in this, he insisted that we cast Eric Stoltz as Marty McFly. Stoltz had just done a very fine picture, Universal, called Mask. But his face was completely covered by this prosthetic. And Sheinberg's thinking was, well, if he can act like that with a prosthetic, he may be better when he's not wearing it. But it didn't work out that way. He didn't have the sort of natural accessibility and comedy timing that the character needed. So after shooting the movie for 5 weeks and putting it together, Bob said, Bob, I need you to look at all this cut footage, which was something I would never do until he had the whole movie cut together in our previous work. But he said, I think we got a real problem here. And I watched the footage, and yeah, sure enough, it wasn't working the way we wanted it to. We showed it to Steven Spielberg, our executive producer, and he agreed. And Steven wisely counseled us. He said, get a replacement lined up before you tell the studio that you want to replace him. Because if you shut down production, you may never restart again. So that was excellent advice. We went back to Family Ties, the producer, who this time it was, you know, 4 or 5 months later than we first approached him. And I think we literally got down on our knees in his office, mm-hmm. begging that he let us use Michael. And he said, okay, you guys, I'll tell you what, if Michael agrees to do this, you have to shoot your schedule around Family Ties. So Family Ties gets Michael in the daytime and you get him at night. Well, now we were going to do anything to get Michael. And we said, yes. And Michael agreed. He said, I'm 22 years old. What do I need to sleep for? And that was how it worked. He would rehearse Family Ties during Monday through Thursday. from like 9 or 10 till 6, get in a car, they take him to the set. We'd shoot with him Back to the Future till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and do it all over again the next day, except on Fridays when they taped the show in front of a live audience. And we didn't get Michael until 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and then we'd shoot with him till dawn. So this was an insane schedule, but people often ask me what my favorite memory of shooting Back to the Future was, and it was the first night Michael came to work, because everybody said, look, this is crazy. Nobody replaces an actor after 5.5 weeks of shooting. Nobody's ever done this unless they die. Do you guys know what you're doing? And Michael comes on the set and he starts shaking hands with everybody. Hey, Mike Fox, good to meet you. And we roll the cameras and everybody in the crew, you just feel the whole company go, oh, that's Marty McFly. It's going to work. The movie's going to work. That leads me to stress how important that is.
That leads me to this question, because Michael J. Fox has this certain je ne sais quoi, and I can't mispronounce it the way they do in your musical. But he has that certain something that makes this character come alive. And when you're casting for the musical version, and there have been several versions now, the West End, the Broadway, the tour, and probably a few others leading up to the West End production, how did you find somebody who could capture that Michael J. Fox magic, knowing that it's not going to be Michael J. Fox? And what happened? What had to happen with those actors to make people forget that they weren't watching Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd, who also, his character is unique as well?
That's a very good question, Mike. And we struggle with that, because the director never told any of the performers, do it like they did it in the movie. That was a direction, those words were never heard. And everybody was told, watch the movie, because this is what the audience is expecting. These are the characters that they know and they love, and put your own spin on it. And some of the cast takes more from the movie than others. Ollie Dobson, who was our first Marty McFly in London, he knew that there were certain things about how Michael J. Fox made his voice crack that the audience would want to hear. So he knew that, you telling me you build a time machine, you have a DeLorean? He had to do that. That really evoked the movie, because people needed to hear it that way. But beyond that, he just took what he could make work for himself. And then once he started playing the role with Roger Bart, who was our very first Doc Brown and is still Doc Brown on Broadway, the chemistry between them developed in a certain way that brought different things to it. We were very sensitive as to how important this was. So at our second workshop, we invited about 20 diehard Back to the Future fans to see it in London, including the two co-presidents of the Michael J. Fox fan club. But we thought, okay, if they hate this, we're back to square one. Right. And at intermission, these two women came over to me and they said, well, we came here thinking, oh, how are they going to do that? Nobody could be Marty McFly except Michael J. Fox. And 6 minutes later, we were going, Michael J. who? It worked.
Bob Gale is our guest. He's the screenwriter for the original and the two following films in the Back to the Future series of movies. And he wrote the book for the musical, which is now on stage at the Belk Theater through the end of the week at blumenthalarts.org. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Bob Gale, screenwriter for Back to the Future, all three movies, and he wrote the book for the musical, which is in Charlotte at the Belk Theater through July 21st. Both the movie and the musical contain this song. Our love is a curious thing. Make a one-man Power of Love, you may have noticed a voice change in the middle of it because we went from Huey's original to the original cast recording. And boy, it has the same amount of power on the stage, maybe more so, I think, than the Huey Lewis song.
You just love hearing that song. You never get tired of it. It's amazing.
I never get tired of it. It's my favorite Huey Lewis and the News song ever. Was it written specifically for Back to the Future?
Sort of. We approached, Bob Zemeckis and I approached Huey Lewis, and we said, look, we would love to get you to write a song for our movie, because our main character would be the type of kid that would be a Huey Lewis fan. And Huey said, oh, I don't know how to write a song for a movie. What do I do? I'm actually working on something. Maybe you guys would like it. And we said, well, great, send it to us. So we got a rough version of Power of Love. And he said, you know, nothing rhymes with future. You know, what am I going to do? A hospital song singing about a suture? No. and we said, that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Just send us what you got. So we heard this rough version of Power of Love and we loved it. And we said, go finish that. That's great. We'll use that. And he kept thinking about it more. And he said, I'm going to write you a second song. And he wrote Back in Time, which obviously we play over the end credits in the movie. And we play as the encore number in the curtain call. So for all of you going to see the show, don't leave. Stay all the way through the end of the curtain call, or you're going to miss Back in Time. And that's the second greatest song for you to bop out of the Blumenthal Center listening to that one.
Well, this is the other thing about transferring this iconic movie to the stage. In the movie, you hear Huey Lewis sing it. In the musical, you hear Marty McFly, the actor playing Marty McFly, sing the song.
And you see him too.
Which makes it a cover tune. It's not the original. It's the new guy, and so he has to meet expectations. And boy, does this guy in the show here meet those expectations. It clearly works. Did you have any misgivings at all about all because you have to replace Michael J. Fox, you got to replace Huey Lewis. Any misgivings at all?
Well, it was very important, actually. Power of Love is a very hard song to sing.
Yeah.
And when we auditioned our Martys, that was always a song we would have the Martys singing in audition, because if they could sing that, they could sing anything. So yeah, I mean, do we have any misgivings? No. Because an interesting thing happens. When you go to theater, there's sort of an unwritten contract between the audience and the performers on stage. You are in the audience and you know, I'm watching live actors up there. They are human beings. I see them. They are doing this right in front of me. They may flub a line, they may miss a cue, and those kind of things make live theater give an extra level of entertainment actually to it. I think some people come see, oh, let's see if they mess up tonight. But there's a suspension of disbelief that you sign on to when you buy your ticket. You know, I'm going to see Caden Brouch and Dawn Stevenson play Marty McFly and Doc Brown, and that's okay. And you want them to be Marty McFly and Doc Brown. And it's the easiest and cheapest Halloween costume in the world, two cheap Halloween costumes. Get an orange down vest and put it over a denim jacket and you're Marty McFly. Or get a white lab coat and a white wig and you're Doc Brown. And those images are so ingrained in culture that everybody can look at somebody wearing an orange down vest over a denim jacket and say, oh, you're Marty McFly.
I want you to know it was 98 degrees here yesterday evening when this show started at 7:30, and there were several people in the audience in orange down vests, because this has become a Beetlejuice-like thing where people dress like the two lead characters when they come to the theater.
I don't know if we have insurance for heat exhaust.
in the original movie, The Power of Love is in that. Several other songs, oldies, like Earth Angel and Johnny B. Goode are in it, and you put them in the musical too, but the musical has a full set of original songs by your composers, Alan Silvestri and
Glenn Ballard.
Glenn Ballard. Thank you very much. Yeah. I guess the question is, because it takes place in two time periods, it gave these two composers a lot of latitude to do various different musical styles.
And beyond that, because, in the 80s, it sounds like 80s music. In the 50s, it sounds like 50s music. We have the number 21st century that kicks off Act Two, and that's techno insanity. That doesn't fit into any genre, really. And of course, when Doc is doing his numbers, they sort of transcend everything. Certainly, for the Dreamers in Act Two, which is the song that gets everybody right here. That's just a classic traditional ballad that you would hear in any kind of musical, except it's all about Doc's struggle, and it's actually all about the struggle of anybody who's creative or anybody who has a dream and trying to realize that dream.
The soundtrack to the movie has a lot of big orchestral sounds, very reminiscent of Star Wars, because it's a science fiction movie, although it's a comedy, it's still science fiction. But it has a soundtrack where the music is reminiscent of that. And I think Alan Silvestri talked in some interview about when they approached this musical version, they approached it as though they were scoring it, which is something you don't necessarily do in musicals. And they have interpolated some of those big orchestral themes that are in the movie into the musical. Can you explain what he was talking about when he was talking about scoring the musical?
Sure. You see, when you go to when you see a musical, a typical musical, it gets to be time for the song and the music kicks in and the performers do the song and then the music goes away. And then there's no music until the next song.
Right.
And we thought, we've got an orchestra here. We're wasting them in between these moments when a little bit of underscore would be really helpful. I mean, the best example of that is when Marty writes the letter to Doc Brown, and that's basically the same exact cue that it is in the movie. And that has so much heart and soul to it, and it brings so much ethos and empathy, and it's so wonderful. And the idea that this is something very, very rare. I think, West Side Story did it because Leonard Bernstein knew how to do that. And I think one part of the reason is that the guys that write songs for musicals, they don't know how to write orchestral cues and underscore. This is what Alan Silvestri does for a living. So he absolutely knows how to do that. So they don't, but typically they don't think that way. And then the musical's a little bit different every night. So that puts a lot of onus on the musical director to say, okay, we have to extend this bar two or three more beats because he took too much time to say his line, or there was a bigger laugh and we had to wait for it. So the musical director has his work cut out for him. And if you go back and watch the show again and you're up close and you watch Matt in Charlotte conducting, it's really interesting. I once in Broadway, I sat in the pit with the musicians to watch our conductor do his thing and see how the musicians did. It was a fascinating process.
So the musical has you and Robert Zemeckis, the brainchild, the brain trust behind the movie, involved in every way. You're both producers. You both co-wrote the scripts. Then you have this musical juggernaut, Alan Silvestri and Glenn Ballard, who have worked in hundreds of films and TV shows. Glenn is a six-time Grammy winner. He's written and produced songs for Aretha Franklin and Barbara Streisand and Dave Matthews and Katy Perry and Alanis Morissette, and I could go on, but we don't have time. He too has worked in musicals. How did the two of these guys end up working on this musical?
When Bob and I started talking about doing a musical, Bob had just finished the Polar Express. Polar Express has six songs in it that were written by Alan and Glenn. And Bob said to me, "Bob, you got to meet Glenn Ballard. I think he's a perfect fit for this. He and Alan working together, I think they would knock this out of the park." So we had a meeting with Alan and Glenn and the two of us, and we all just hit it off. I felt like I'd known Glenn my whole life. That's the chemistry that we had there. And we all just had this really easy camaraderie with one another. And we basically said to these guys, after we said, "This is our vision for it." And they said, "Yeah, we get that. We get that. Why don't you guys go write some songs and come back in a couple of weeks and play us what you did?" And that's what happened. And they came back and they played us three or four songs. One of which had to have been Only a Matter of Time, which is putting lyrics to the theme of Back to the Future. That was a given that we had to do that. And the other songs that they wrote Pretty Baby. They wrote Hello, Is Anybody Home? So a different version of It Works. And they were spot on. They caught the humor. They caught the irreverence. They caught the fact that we were kind of walking this line between playing it straight and almost kind of doing a parody of musicals, if you will. Because as Bob Zemeckis said, well, you know, look, it's a musical comedy. People just show up and they just start singing. You know, let's just do that. That's great. That's fun. That's why people do it. And then when we're rehearsing the number It Works, and we have Doc with these dancing girls, Roger Bart was saying, where are these girls, where do they come from? Are they the cleaning crew at Wind Pines Mall? And we said, well, no, they just show up whenever you start singing. And that's, we put that in the show.
Yeah, that's the line of the show.
and it perfectly encapsulates the tone of the show. The audience loves that. And we're just saying to the audience, that is what kind of show you're seeing here.
There's that line in the first act, which sets up a joke in the second act, where they're in the middle of this big production number, and suddenly they change scenes, and the Doc's house comes into view, and he and Marty are in the house, but some of the singers and dancers are somehow trapped. They're left behind, and they don't know what to do with them. I don't want to give away the joke, but that's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
It's a real Mel Brooks moment. Yeah,
it's truly wonderful. You mentioned that you know, it's a musical where characters have to sing, and a lot of people don't like musicals because characters have to sing. Why do they sing? We don't need to hear them sing. Yes, we do. What has allowing your characters to sing done for your story?
The counterpart to a close-up in a movie is a song in a musical. It's the counterpart to a soliloquy, and like in a Shakespeare, you know, Hamlet says to be or not to be in the musical version of Hamlet, which I guess somebody did it. He would sing that. So it gives us a way deeper into the character. The character can express who they are. So their songs are called I Am songs, that has an actor talking about who they are, what their dreams are. And this is a staple of musical theater. We have had a tremendous amount of people come to see Back to the Future, the musical, who have never seen a musical before. And they come because it's Back to the Future. And they say, well, I wouldn't normally go see a musical, but it's Back to the Future, and I want to see how they do the car, and I want to see how they bring these characters to life. And they come out of the theater dancing, and they're just really, really happy. So it's nice to think that this is a gateway drug to musical theater for a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's these songs allow the characters not just to reveal their inner thoughts, their inner monologue, and tell you more about themselves and what they're thinking. It makes it, I think the songs make the characters more three-dimensional because they can sing things that they would never say, or if they said exactly. It would fall kind of flat. But you have to write for that, and having already written this movie script, and now you're writing the stage script for a musical, you have to allow for those songs to suddenly pop up. How difficult was that? How did you know that a song belongs here?
Sometimes it was trial and error. I'll go back to For the Dreamers, because that was an interesting, really interesting song where Glenn Ballard just, he said, Doc needs a song. I'm going to write this song. And he called me over to his studio and he played this for me. And I was just completely blown away. And he said, Bob, I don't know where this goes, but something tells me that we need this song in the show. And as soon as I heard it, I said, damn right, we need this song in the show. And then John Rando flew in and he heard it and he had the same reaction. So I tested a bunch of different places, and John did too, in Act Two, where this could go. And finally, what I realized was I had to rewrite the structure of Act Two to allow this song to have its moment in the sun.
There is another song in this show that a different character sings that you decided this character has to have a song, and he does, and we're going to come back and hear that song in a moment, and you can talk about it, and we can also talk about the incredible technical aspect of Back to the Future. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
There's something about that punk that I don't trust. He's dangerous. There's something that don't add up. Arithmetic and a hockey stick. There's something about that guy.
Since he appeared.
Yeah, there's something that's all messed up. It don't make sense how he's dressed up.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Gale, the screenwriter and the book writer for the musical of Back to the Future, is with us for the hour. Back to the Future is at the Belk Theater in its second week, beginning tonight through this coming Sunday. BlumenthalArts.org for tickets. Every story has to have an antagonist. That in this story is Biff. He is the bully who harasses Marty's dad throughout the movie and throughout the musical, and his boss as a grown-up. You said that when you talk to others about the prospect of doing this musical or the show as a musical, people said, I can't wait to hear Biff sing. So he has to sing. How did that come about?
Well, exactly that. He had to sing. And what was fun, we played around with how we were going to do Biff singing, because everybody remembers Biff for all of his malprops, right? make like a tree and get out of here instead of make like a tree and leave, and various other things. So we thought, well, should Biff sing off key? And we decided, no, that would be too jarring, but the lyrics can't make a whole lot of sense. He's got to mess up the lyric. And a funny anecdote, when our first actor playing Biff in Aidan Cutler in London, he told the story, he's practicing the song in his flat, and his flatmate said, "Are you sure those are the right words? They don't make any sense." And yeah, they were the right words. I'll pay his dues. I'll shine his shoes. It doesn't make any sense, but that's Biff. And the audience loves it. And his guys, his two goons are trying to correct him. But, you know, the secret of understanding Biff is Biff thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, but he's actually the dumbest guy in the room.
Right. I can think of some, never mind. we won't bring politics into this.
Yeah, let's not do that. Back to the Future is a respite from the world. It's a respite from politics. If you want to forget all your troubles, all your cares, and be transported away from all the insanity that's going on, as what Huey Lewis said when he saw it, he said, "God, isn't it great to have this experience where you forget everything and just enjoy the show?"
You are the original screenwriter. You wrote the book. You have been described in some circles as the gatekeeper of the franchise. You wrote all three films, now the musical. I believe you have this affinity for comic books and superheroes, yes, which we can talk about. But how do you take your own material, which has already been incredibly successfully produced, and then have to make it into a musical where you have a whole different creative team with whole different sensibilities who understand theater, but maybe not movies, and the other way around. And you bring in a guy like John Rando, who's the director of this. We're going to talk about the technical aspects of this show, but the technical aspects, even though they are remarkable, his staging of this is remarkable.
It is. It is. And one of the most gratifying things that made this into such a glorious creative experience for me is that everybody working on the musical really wanted to be here. They are all fans of the movie. And they came to this saying, "I love this movie. I want to be involved in putting it on the stage. And I promise I'm not going to be the one to screw it up." And so that, to me, to say, oh, I mean, the producer, Colin Ingram, he was 16 years old or 14, I forget which, when he saw the movie for the first time, and he wanted to be Marty McFly, and he learned to ride a skateboard. So this sort of thing brings something out of our creative team to say, I'm not going to rest until I figure out how to do the DeLorean on stage. At the same time, my job was to say, hey, this is a musical and it's on stage and it cannot be a slavish recreation of the movie, because people just want to see the movie. It's on Netflix right now. Right. You can watch it on Netflix today. And you don't have to go to the theater if that's what you want to see, but you do have to go to the theater to have the audience experience and to have this new version of the story that you love tailored to the stage and done on stage in a way that makes sense. So for example, yeah, the first thing I cut out was a skateboard chase, because there's no way we're gonna get an actor to play Marty McFly who can sing, who can dance, who can act, who can be funny, and who can do skateboard stunts. That's never gonna happen. And if he's doing skateboard stunts every night, he could get hurt. He could break his ankle, and then what do we do? So cut it out. Come up with something else that will dramatically work just as well, and the audience won't miss it. And the same thing with the terrorist chase at the mall. Well, we didn't want to have gunfire on stage. We want this. It's a family show. It's going to terrify kids. And how are you going to do a car chase on a stage? Let's not even go there. So I had to come up with a dramatic substitute that works equally as well dramatically. that gives Marty the impetus to say, I got to get back home because Doc, I got to save Doc's life. And I'm not telling you what it is, but
right.
I think, Mike, you'll agree, it works.
I think it works perfect. Better. I think it works better, particularly in today's climate. It worked. This is not 1985. It kind of works better. It takes an enormous amount of time to get a normal musical into development and then onto a stage and into full production. I mean, it can take years and years for that to happen. This is such a complicated endeavor. And you have not only the technical aspects of having this car have to fly and some of the other things that happen, the way the transitions are done as Doc climbs the clock tower and it goes back from the clock tower to the car to the clock tower to the car is very cinematic and incredibly difficult to achieve in live, real time on a stage. How long did it take to figure all this out in the various permutations that led to the first production in the West End?
Well, we opened the show in Manchester, actually, to kind of test it out. And that was in 2020. And after five real performances and 15 previews, COVID shut us down. So that was, oh my God, that was horrifying to have to do all this and then
shut it down.
We tested it. We tried it. And after every show, we said, okay, maybe that's a little bit too long. Maybe the car doesn't need to do all that stuff. So on our opening night in Manchester, the car sequence with the clock tower, that was 11 minutes long. And in the version that you're going to see at the Blumenthal Center, it's about 5.5 minutes long. So we cut it in half because you realize the audience is way ahead of you often. And you don't want to show too much of your magic trick for too long, or the audience will start looking at that and you'll lose the drama. So right. There was first the part of the showmanship where, I mean, I was used to this in movies because you say, okay, yeah, okay, we did that, but we got to cut it out. But we had our theatrical team, and they'd never had these paintbrushes and these toys and these tools, and they wanted to show off every possible thing that the car could do. And Alan Silvestri and I were saying, no, you don't need to do that. This is good enough. The audience will get it. Don't bore them. They'll get bored seeing it. They want to see just enough of this to say, whoa, how'd they do that? And then boom, you're someplace else.
And the car, of course, everybody knows if they've seen the movie, the car has to hit 88 miles an hour or he can't come back. And 88 is the key number in all of that. But the car cannot, on a 60-foot stage, cannot move 88 miles per hour. Otherwise, you wouldn't see it. It'd be gone. And it would hit the sidewall of the theater and the show would be over. So it's completely believable that this car is moving that fast. And what's more, you are seeing it from the camera's point of view. It's very cinematic because you see it turn, you see it move, you see the background move faster than the car so that it's as though the camera is moving away from the car. It's really remarkably well done. Is that the job of an illusionist? Is that the job of the director? Who figured all this out?
Everybody worked together to come up with this, except me. They just said, okay, Bob, you write the funny stuff. You know, write the lines. We'll figure this out. And I said, well, what if you did this? What if you did? No, we got this. We got this, Bob. We got this. But we had our production designer, our director, our illusionist, and our video guy, and our sound guy all working together to say, okay, we need to pool our talents. It was a group effort. It really was, so that everybody could sit around and say, all right, how do we do this? What can we make a car do? What can we make the background do? And we have a background, a video backdrop, and we also have gauze that will drop down in the front where we can do video projection in the front. So we have two planes of movement with the car in the middle. And we use lighting, both the lights coming onto the car and the lights that are within the car to make the wheels look like they're going around and around. And one of the things that we did to make this theatrical, we knew we couldn't do a close-up of like the time displays. So, and this is where I came in. I said, we're going to have the car talk. So the car talks. So when Doc programs the destination time, he says, set the destination time for October 26, 1985, 1:41 a.m., and the car repeats it. So the audience gets it into their head where the car is going, and we don't have to show close-up because we didn't want to do that. That was just theater.
And in 1985, if you had done that in the movie, people would have seen that as futuristic. Today, we all have Alexa and Siri and things like that. And I'm just curious about the voice. The voice sounded of the car sounded strangely familiar to me. Is it a well-known voice that perhaps is the voice of one of those AI devices?
It is an AI voice. It was created by our sound guy, Gareth Owen.
Wow.
And I don't know if it imitates, it's not the Google voice. I know that since I hear the Google voice all the time. And I don't have an Alexa, so I don't know if it sounds like that. But it is done in real time every night. And I'm going to give away a joke that people sometimes get and they sometimes don't. But it's one of my favorite things. And we were trying to figure out, okay, at the end, they're going to go to the future. You know, we got to come back with me. Where? Back to the future. Well, where are they going to go? In the movie, they go to 2015, which in 1985 was 30 years in the future. Well, that's the past, though, for us sitting in the theater. So the voice, he said, program destination time. And we hear the voice give the actual date and time of the very show that the audience is sitting in. So it's as if Doc and Marty are getting into the car. Doc is going to take Marty to see the show that the audience has just seen.
Yeah, it's Charlotte, it's the Blumenthal, it's 7:30, it's the date of the performance that you are watching, which is pretty clever. And it's also projected that way at some point in the show as well. This all hinges. Doing this musical, I have like 2 minutes left, but doing this musical all hinges on your being able to do that car. Do you wish it had not been a car? Do you wish it had been, you wish it had been a refrigerator or something simpler?
Well, given how well it works, I'm thrilled that it's a car.
Well, did you know you could do it?
That's the greatest effect I've seen.
It's true, but did you know what would have happened had you not been able to do it?
Oh, I don't know. I don't speculate about things like that. We just try to solve the problems that we have and use them as opportunities to say, how can we make this the greatest show that anybody's ever seen?
When you and Robert Zemeckis wrote the original film, I don't believe you had any intention of there being two sequels to that film. I'm sure when you sat down to write the musical, you have no intention, maybe you do, I don't know, of having sequels to the musical. But in 30 seconds or less, will there be a sequel?
No, there's not going to be a sequel. And the reason for it, I learned a lot about musical theater in this process. The best musicals have a good, strong love story. Back to the Future Part 2 is all plot. There's no love story in it. And that would not work on stage. 3 might, but not 2. So we'll just quit while we're ahead. Back to the Future, the musical, is terrific. Go see it. Go see it twice. 3 times. Whatever. It's great.
Ka-ching. Bob Gale, the screenwriter and also the writer of the book for the musical and the co-creator and the producer of Back to the Future, the musical, at the Blumenthal through Sunday. Thanks so much for the honor.
You're welcome.
Happy to be here.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.